Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Welcome back to All of It. Back in January, we spoke with Gabrielle Bendiner-Vianne, an artist, curator, and visiting assistant professor at the New School, about her book, Contested City, Art and Public History as Mediation at New York's Seward Park Urban Renewal Area. Her book explains how the Seward Park Urban Renewal Area, right around the Delancey-Essex stop in the Lower East Side, was initially made up of tenement houses and co-ops that the city forced residents to vacate in the 60s. Many of the buildings then sat empty for years before being razed. All in all, 1,852 families were displaced and were promised that they would be given the opportunity to move back into the affordable housing units that would eventually be built on the sites of their former homes. Instead, what resulted was a 50-year-long fight for affordable housing. Now, these 14 city blocks are finally being developed. Known as Essex Crossing, this new development includes permanent affordable housing and also houses the new Essex Market. Bendiner-Vianne's book also inspired a new exhibition at the Artists Alliance Cuchafritos Gallery and Project Space inside the new Essex Market at 88 Essex Street. It's called Keep Me Nearby. The show includes photographs by Nick Lawrence that depict the interiors of some of the apartments that were demolished at Spura in the 60s and 70s. The show is on view now through July 21st, and Bendiner-Vianne will also be giving free tours at the site as part of her decade-long layered Spura project, happening at 2 p.m. on Saturday, July 20th. Let's take a listen now to part of her January interview here on All of It. You're a native New Yorker. How did you come to learn about Spura?
I absolutely am, and I think that's really a big part of the way that I came to learn about Spura. So I grew up in New York. I have a huge affection for it. I really care about the city. I teach about urban studies. This is what I do all the time. And grew up going to the Lower East Side with my family, you know, kind of harking back both sides of my family, have connections to the Lower East Side. And at one point, I was starting, right when I started to teach at the New School, I was starting to talk with Marcy Reaven, who was part of an organization called City Lore at the time. And we were thinking, well, what would it look like to develop a class where there's a partnership around kind of community work and thinking about making things public at the same as thinking about kind of what does that look like for pedagogy around understanding cities. And she said, well, I think that's a great idea, and I'd love to collaborate with you, but, you know, the only thing I have going on right now is this crazy Spura situation. And I was like, Spura?
Spura situation?
What's that? And so this is 2008, and we took a long walk from the New School to the corner of Grand and Essex, and on the way, she told me the potted history, basically, of this site and the ways in which she had started getting involved and collaborating with an organization called Good Old Lower East Side, which is also known as GOLS.
Cool.
Yeah. Who's been long-term activists on housing around the Lower East Side. And when we arrived at the corner of Grand and Essex, and as I'd been sort of listening to this story and going, wait, what? And then, wait, tell me what, when that happened? We got there and I thought, I've been here a million times. How do I not know this story? And that was really part of the thing that drove me to think a lot more deeply about the site and to commit a lot of years of my life to working with it and working on it, because it was such a powerful story and such an important story, but also one that it's not just me that didn't know about it, but that many people, unless you were really quite directly affected, it wasn't a well-known story, and yet it's such a complicated one and one that really touches on the stories of lots of parts of New York.
And it points to all the issues.
Right.
Well, it's just like... just all of them in one right. big one big bowl. You quote an activist as saying, unless it's written, it never happened. This is very significant when you think about how it relates to discriminations, particularly in this case.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's one of the things that really also kind of helped me keep going in writing the book, is thinking about, well, what are the points of, you know, what's the point of writing a book about this? You know, what's the point of my writing a book about it? What's the point of doing work around it? And part of it really is to kind of have this story be out in the world as opposed to being only known by people who've lived it and experienced it. That's incredibly important and powerful that people kind of have lived and experienced it and stay involved and invested in it. But also, how do we make that more public so that people really understand what happened at Spura and so that even in this moment where, you know, very big and shiny new buildings are being built there, what happens so that there's not an erasure of both the history of why those buildings were torn down in the first place, but also the multiple levels of history, discrimination, and really long-term and incredible activism that happened since then, so that those things aren't erased and we don't forget about those things and we don't lose the way that that helps us understand the rest of the city.
All right, let's do a little timeline for
folks.
Absolutely. So the Lower East Side, it was a landing point for many immigrant groups in the 19th and 20th century. So at that time, the clearing of the buildings, who was living in this neighborhood?
Sure. So the site was declared an urban renewal site in 1967. And at that time, in this particular swath of the neighborhood, which is about 14 square blocks, pretty large area of solidly packed tenement buildings, it was an incredibly diverse neighborhood, mostly lower income people of color, but incredible diversity in that group, and also groups of Holocaust survivors as well. So you have these people kind of who had been refugees after World War II had settled back in the neighborhood. So it wasn't always this kind of older generation of people who'd live on the Lower East Side, but newer immigrants of all different kinds coming to the Lower East Side. There's a very significant Puerto Rican population at Seward Park. And that there was a very, you know, people talk about it as an incredible neighborhood that they've never really experienced since. And you might be kind of tempted to see that as like a sort of a past looking back kind of nostalgia of like, it was all so much better and we all got along and all that kind of thing. But what's interesting about that is that because there's so much historical record and court cases and discrimination sort of lawsuits brought around the kind of housing and discrimination that happened on the site later, we actually can see pretty closely about census records and court records of who was there and what the racial breakdown was. And so there was a very significant group of number of families who were Puerto Rican, but also African American, also Jewish, white, and also a smaller number, but certainly present, of Asian families who were there. It was really at the beginning of this, at 67, was really the beginning of kind of the emergence of Chinatown in that area. So there was a smaller number of Asian families there, but really kind of significantly diverse and really integrated as those blocks.
So why was it decided that this area needed to be cleared and renewed, which a lot of people, they say urban renewal and you hear urban removal. That's, you know.
Absolutely. And I think that was one of the things that, you know, many people talk about as urban renewal. People alternately talk about it as Negro renewal, right? Or removal,
yeah.
Right? And so that was a phrase used at the time, and it was certainly applicable in this situation, right? People also talk about it as Latino removal, right? And so those things are real, and those were part of urban renewal across the board. It's not specific to Spura. It's one of the many things that happened across New York City and across the country, and the ways in which this kind of vast removal of people was really deployed in neighborhoods of color and where people often didn't have the chance to kind of mobilize and fight back against it.
It was in the name of what? Was it just progress?
So in the name of progress, certainly. And, you know, I mean, so at the time, so all of this is under the auspices of the Slum Clearance Committee, with a fantastic
name,
right? Right. So already you're kind of like going crazy, right? Led by Robert Moses, also intersecting with one of his other projects, which was the Lower Manhattan Expressway. So he had big plans for taking out part of this neighborhood for an expressway that would cut across all of Lower Manhattan, kind of connecting off of the Williamsburg Bridge, and also that this would be, you know, a site of new housing. So on one hand, there's this idea that, you know, urban renewal had been used in many, many ways across the city and made some things that we could argue are incredibly important contributions to the city, right? We can also look at the kinds of displacement that those developments sort of wrought. But it also did develop some of our largest amounts of affordable housing, particularly affordable like ownership housing, co-op housing. So those were also built through urban renewal. Mm-hmm. The thing that happened at Spura, and part of the reason that people left was they were promised the right to come back. And they said, you know, we're going to build enough apartments for all of you to be able to return, right? There was, and it's talked about in this way, as a right to return. And that was part of the deal of leaving, that people would be temporarily relocated and be able to come back. And part of what happened at Spurrow was that the way that urban renewal functions is that the city doesn't redevelop a site. They have a sponsor, and that person, that organization is the kind of, they are the developer of the site. The developer of this site was supposed to be the United Housing Federation, which had developed many other urban renewal sites for moderate income co-ops often around the city. Just on the other opposite side of Grand Street, they had developed those. Had done a lot of work in the Bronx as well. So had this real history of building housing that was affordable. But they, at some point, for many reasons, decided they would pull out before the buildings were demolished. And so the city went ahead in starting in 67 and 68 to demolish buildings without having a sponsor to build anything to replace them.
Wow.
And so that's part of the tragedy of Spurrow, is that not only does it kind of pull up all these questions about displacement and who's being displaced, but also these questions of the fact that people were being displaced without really any promise of what was going to come to be able to be a place for them to come back to.
Now, to be clear, was there ever affordable housing for them to come back to?
Ever built?
Yes.
Yes, in bits and pieces.
Okay.
So
but only certain people were welcome back.
Right. So, you know, the plot thickens as soon as you go forward with it. Yes. So the first sponsor to build housing on that site was the New York City Housing Authority, so NYCHA, to build two buildings of public housing on that site, which is called the Seward Park Extension Buildings. And one of them, and they exist today, they're there. One of them is on between Delancey and Broome, and the other is on the corner of Grand and Essex. And those two buildings, when they were built, people were very excited about them. You know, they were going to be modern apartments. You know, many of the tenements that were torn down, they weren't in great condition. People were like, okay, you're going to give me like a better looking house? Like, okay, I would go for that. Many of those apartments that were built in Seward Park Extension, you know, they were very nice apartments. Everything worked. It was all great. There were elevators, you know, this wasn't walk-ups. And people were promised that they would have the priority to come back. And so people started to do that. They said, okay, I'm going to come to the rental office. I'm going to try and lease these apartments. And what people were finding was that families of color were turning up and they were saying, okay, here's my proof. This is where I lived. I wanted one of those apartments. And they were saying, oh, I'm sorry. They're all rented. And people started to notice that there was a pattern, that the majority of families who were getting apartments in those two buildings were white and Jewish.
Did they give a reason why?
Well, later in the court cases that were brought against them, they gave some very significant reasons why, and which only really evolved through kind of direct action and the kind of, you know, people taking over the rental offices, having sit-ins, really kind of vital and important kinds of activist work that was happening there. And one of the arguments that NYCHA made at the time was they, and really reinscribed in the court cases, was this idea of a tipping point, that they argued that were they to let the people of color who had lived there before return, there would be this notion that it would be too many colored people in the neighborhood and would tip the neighborhood and it would lead to this notion of white flight, right? And so all of that language is part of the way that they talked about it in those court cases. And so these are the legal documents in which NYCHA was trying to defend the decisions that they had made about who they would lease to.
Your project of Layered Spurrow. Explain to folks what it is and what you hope it achieves.
Sure. So the project really started in 2008 when I started to work with good old Lower East Side, with City Lore, with the Pratt Center, where they were really trying to build a conversation and a grassroots conversation from the bottom up to before any of this Essex Crossing business was happening, to say, well, what would it look like to actually start a community conversation about this site and the future of this site? And so one of our contributions to that coalition of people working together on this was to do a series of exhibitions for 5 years about Seward Park or about Seward Park Urban Renewal Area itself, mm-hmm. as a place, as its history, as a place where people had lived, that they cared about, that they loved, and to bring that kind of humanity back to it, and to take it away from the kind of the only dialogue that was happening was around, you know, how many developable square feet is it, right? At the time, it was the largest undeveloped city-owned plot of land south of 96th Street, is very significant amount of space. But one of the things that we really wanted to talk about was like, well, this is and was people's homes. So mm-hmm. how can exhibitions and creative practices also help us see that, right? How do we build in oral history, all of those things that help us sort of let us see the city as a human place, not just a place of, you know, possible building. And so Layered Spura was a project in conjunction with a class that I taught called City Studio at the New School, in which I brought all of my students into collaboration with all of the folks who were working on this coalition, which was called Spura Matters, and to develop these exhibitions each year that were community-based mm-hmm. exhibitions. And one of the things that the book is about is both about the development of those exhibitions and also about the kind of what those spaces have the possibility to create. One of the things I always thought about, you know, I thought, oh, this is going to be great. We're going to have all these images. I think photography is fantastic. I think people's stories are wonderful. But I think I didn't really understand what the whole thing was about until we got to one of the exhibition openings. And there were quite a few people there who were a little angry that we were doing an exhibition about Spura. Because they were saying, what are you saying in our name? And who has the right to talk about Spura? And it ended up being a lot of people from sort of opposite sides of the kind of argument about Spura, which had been going on for about 40 years That's by then, turning up at this exhibition. And somebody sort of leaned over to me and said, you know, I've never seen those two people in the same room without screaming at each other. And I thought, oh, okay, maybe that's what we're doing.
There you go.
You know, maybe that's this possibility. And so it's really made me think about the possibility for both Spura itself, but also this kind of practice in our very contested cities going forward, is what does it mean to both sort of, I don't think that an exhibition solves any problems. And there is a huge amount of work that brought us from nothing to the pretty significant agreements that led to Essex Crossing. But one of the things that I really think was important, and what I want to take away from it, was thinking about how can we make more of those kinds of spaces where people who really are at loggerheads with each other, who can't see each other, can't hear each other, can't mm-hmm. see each other as, you know, other people, have a space to have some sort of even very minor kind of dialogue. And what does it take to get us to that, right? I mean, it's obviously happening at the national level too. But so that was one of the most important things, I think, that we took away from doing the Layered Spura work.
That was Gabrielle Bendiner-Vianney talking about her book, Contested City, Art and Public History as Mediation at New York's Seward Park Urban Renewal Area. You can check out the exhibition that has grown out of her book. It's up now at the Artists Alliance Cuchafritos Gallery and Project Space inside the new Essex Market at 88 Essex Street. It's happening through Sunday, July 21st. Titled Keep Me Nearby, the show includes photographs by Nick Lawrence that depict the interiors of some of the apartments that were demolished at Spura in the 1960s and 70s. She'll also be there giving free tours on the site as part of her decade-long Layered Spura project. That's happening on Saturday, July 20th. You can sign up at the gallery's website or simply meet at the gallery at 2 p.m. This is All of It on WNYC.